This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Coming to the bat for the answers here.
The one show that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life.
You guys talk about a lot of really good information that even I can understand.
Call Ray now at 844-RAY-SHOW, 844-RAY-SHOW. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and welcome to the one talk show in America that helps you make better money moves. A loaded show today, and I'm not talking about Johnny Dean.
Loaded show, loaded hosts, not us.
But no. We've got a lot on the agenda. We're going to have to talk really, really fast. I'll apologize in advance for that. I spoke in front of a group of mostly Hispanic-speaking financial advisors last week. They had translators and all that, and the translator came up to me before I went to speak. Now, most of them spoke English, but some of them didn't.
Yeah.
And he said, could you slow down your speech a little bit? And I laughed at him. I said, are you kidding me? I've been talking like this for the last 30 years on the radio.
You can't change your old habits. Yeah.
So after the speech, I went up to him. I said, was I a little too fast? And he said, yep.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure. Didn't that happen once? We were on the radio in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Do you remember
that? You have a good memory.
And this was 20 years ago. And I got a call from the program director because the show had just started there. They just picked us up in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And the program director says, hey, listen, there's just one thing. Can you all talk just a little bit slower? Yeah. We don't listen so fast here in Tennessee. This is exactly what he told me. I'm not making fun of anybody. That's exactly what he said.
I remember that.
So we had that issue, too, at one point.
And we tried, and then we didn't do it.
We did it for about 10 seconds.
That's the way we are.
We had too much to talk about.
Okay, so I've got all this stuff. I've got the Social Security expansion bill, Glide Path, which we have to get to. We didn't get to last hour. A new survey from the AICPA on their clients' top retirement planning fear. But since you remembered the program director from Murfreesboro,
yes,
I will see if you remember something we talked about a good 15 years ago on the air.
Lay it on me. I don't know what it is.
Charlie Munger. We didn't talk about Charlie Munger, but no. Charlie Munger's, by the way, he's 95. And still lucid and talking about stocks. That's Warren Buffett's partner for umpteen years, right?
Business partner.
Here's what he had to say on, I guess it was CNBC the other day. Teaching young people to actively trade stocks is like starting them on heroin. Sit back, folks. Relax. I'm going to see if Johnny Dean can remember when we talked about this 15 years ago on the air.
We talked about Charlie Munger.
No, we didn't talk about Charlie Munger.
Well, we talked about teaching young people to pick stocks.
Well, I was anti it.
Yes, I know. I know you well enough.
You came to me at a request from your daughter, Carla. Do you remember she was in, she's probably a sophomore in high school, and her class was doing one of these stupid, idiotic.
The stock picking challenge
or something like that.
I have not thought of that.
For 15 years.
For 15 years. How in the world did you remember that? She was in, you're right.
Well,
she was a freshman or sophomore.
I read this article.
I'm saying
Charlie Munger is 100% right. Not only is he a genius, but he's given young people really good advice. And let's give all these schools some really good advice here. That is one of the dumbest things ever, despite the fact that your daughter won the contest.
She did. They had a stock picking contest, and I brought it up, I think, on the air.
You did.
And you were saying that's ridiculous, and you said something like, you know what, let's find something for her. Let's just show how ridiculous this is. And I think you've picked some high-flying, volatile something stock, and it was you're supposed to track it over the course of, I think it was like two weeks.
It was after the tech crash.
Oh, yeah, it was a few years afterwards.
And tech stocks got hammered.
Yes.
And I figured that they were poised to make some kind of, I don't remember the stock, to be honest
with you. I don't know what it was either.
So I went into my charts and graphs and all this stuff, trying to find some stock that was way oversold.
Of course.
And I'm sure it was a small cap name.
Oh, it was.
She won the contest.
And you weren't even trying to do that. You just said, here, it's almost like throwing a dart. You said,
I basically threw a dart.
And she won the contest. But that didn't really do anything for, you know, our argument that you shouldn't be doing this. But yes, You cannot sit there and tell kids, hey, folks, this is a good way to do it. Let's all get together and pick stocks, and we'll analyze them here in class, and we'll figure out which is the best one, and whatever one comes out in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'll have to also make a confession, because at the same time, long about the same time, I was doing a lot of the CNBC shows and Fox Business, or I don't think Fox Business was...
I don't think so, but it was around. There were a lot of those.
Kabuto.
Yeah.
And anyway, I was doing... Regularly, I was on these programs, and I hated doing the Bulls and Bears show, because they would always ask you, what's your stock pick for the
down
next 6 months?
They went to the three or four people on the panel. Right. You were one of them, and what's your stock? Yeah.
So they asked me for a stock that's going to make at least 25% in the next 6 months. And I'm going like, as if any of us morons on this panel know. So I did the same thing. I went back, and I looked at a stock that was oversold, and I found some educational stock. I can't remember what the name of the company at this point. And it was a company I'd never studied before, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, that's the one. So, and I'll never forget, I was appearing on Friday, and I'm doing the show from Long Island. You're in San Diego.
Yes, we're on a Long Island station.
I'm on a station in Long Island. And they call me during one of the breaks, and they say, by the way.
The TV.
By the way, the stock that you picked is up 25% today. And I'm going, yeah, so what? I'm a genius. They said, well, do you want to stick with the stock or come up with another one? Well, I had a super busy day. I said, no, I'm sticking with the stock.
You're going to go out a winner with, oh, please. I don't even know what happened to it after that.
Oh, I don't know.
I'm sure it dumped and then.
It doesn't matter. Knows? It was all back in the day when the stock market was going up so dramatically and small caps were going crazy, because anybody that studies the market knows that small caps are the quickest to recover after a big crash, and this was after the crash, and small caps were killing it, right?
Historically, they have been. It doesn't mean that every time, but yes, of course.
So anyway, if your kid or grandchild is in one of these stock-picking classes, tell them don't take it seriously. Charlie Munger is right. It's like starting them on heroin, teaching them to trade. And there's a lesson in all of this as well. Do you know how many sponsors have come to me and said they want to sponsor the show? And I apologize to all of the radio stations out there and the TV stations and all of that, because I've turned all of them down, because it would be something I'd probably have to go to confession on,
because you
talk
preach
to them
against
on senior.
Well, I'm surprised that, I mean, you had to do it. I think when you did this on these business shows way back when, that you would preface it by saying, I don't like to do this. I don't believe that picking stocks. But if it's part of the segment, here's the stock I like.
Yeah, except for then they'd say something in your ear like, you're never coming back on this show again. So I did. I did drop doing those shows.
Well, because you don't
believe
it. I
would just do the basic, you know, CFP shows, or if you want to do a calculation and retirement shows or whatever, I can do those.
It was a lot of strategy.
I quit doing those because, you know, it's just like Cramer. People listen to him, and they go out and buy what he says to buy or sell or whatever. And folks, he's only been right, according to the gurus that actually track this stuff, 46% of the time. I remember once on one of those shows pulling a quarter out of my pocket and flipping the quarter up. I was talking to one of the other brokers, and he was chastising me for not wanting to pick a stock. And I said, well, your track record's not so good. You're up 43% of the time. I know that because I looked at the CXO whatever advisory. I said, I got a quarter here. Boom, and I flipped it. They didn't invite me back on that show either.
Oh, no. And so you could be right 50% of the time.
50% of the time. Anyway, let's move on to the discussion on GlidePath, because we talked about this last hour and couldn't get to it. And it's an important conversation because, according to Nick Thornton, who wrote, I think, for Think Advisor, it's one of the most used jargon-type terms, and most employees with 401k plans have no idea what it means.
So in other words, what they're doing is going to these 401k, are they the 401k administrators or the HR people or whoever, are going to the employees talking about 401k asset allocation, and they throw in a term like glide path.
Yeah, they surveyed 800 401k plans, 800 of them, and they asked about different jargon and so forth. And the target date funds, which most employees jump on, that's the default mechanism. If you go into a 401k plan, you have no idea which funds to pick, They take a look at your age and automatically put you in a target date fund that becomes more conservative every year or every 5 years as you get older. It reduces the equity glide path.
Yeah, you're not as exposed to stocks. They'll pick, okay, I'm 20 years out from retirement, so we'll put you in a what they call a 2040 fund, meaning you're retiring in the year 2040, which means that as you get closer to 2040, the year, your exposure to stocks goes down in such a way that you should be okay by the time you retire.
Yeah, and it's not a bad strategy leading up to retirement, but when we come back from the break, I'm going to explain why it could be a horrible strategy once you retire. Again, it doesn't seem logical that you would be more aggressive, but stick around. This is The Ray Lucia Show.
Business owner, want a bpreneur, or just looking to manage your assets? You found the right place. Biz Talk Radio.
So I've got a question for you, Johnny Dean. Have you seen Bohemian Rhapsody?
No, and I should have. I don't get to the movies. But
you can rent it. Actually, I think we're going to buy
the theaters
it for $22 on whatever the TV, whatever my wife has.
Okay.
DirecTV, I think it is.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can own it, and you can keep playing that song back over and over again.
I assume they play that, and I assume they play Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oscar-winning performance by Rami, whatever his name is, Malek.
Yeah?
Wow.
Yeah.
They made him up to look exactly like Freddie Mercury. The overbite,
something?
The whole deal.
Yeah, wow.
He kind of has one to begin with.
Yeah?
But they made it like the Freddie Mercury overbite. He looked just like him, and his performance moves, if you haven't seen it, folks, it's incredible.
It's been out a while.
Yeah.
Or it came out a while. I think it may just be on video now. I have no idea.
It's phenomenal. Okay. Back on the glide path discussion. So when you enter a 401k plan, most employers, there's over $1 trillion now invested in these glide path age-based target date funds. And I don't like them for a number of different reasons. Number one, they're way too diversified. And number two, many of them continue the glide path post-retirement. That's the part I really don't like. Now, I suggest to you that a rising equity glide path, the exact opposite of what they do in a target date fund post-retirement, is probably a dumb thing to do. Let me see if I can find what they have to say about it here. Okay, for instance, a portfolio, and this is Michael Kitsis, I believe, that wrote this. Yes. A portfolio that starts at 60% equities and ends 60% in equities has a 93.2% probability of success. However, a portfolio that starts at 30% equities and finishes at 70% equities actually has a 95.1% probability of success, not to mention lower average equity exposure through retirement. Translation, less risk, a better chance to succeed. Why wouldn't you want that?
I'd want it. Are we talking about a portfolio that starts at retirement? We're not talking about somebody who's 25
working
their way. No,
you're now retired.
Yeah, I want to make sure that people understand the difference between the savings part, the accumulation part of their life, and the distribution part.
Huge
big difference. And that's what we're talking about, the distribution part here.
Yeah, so, and they go on to talk about the magnitude of potential failures. And I think what's really important is this, and I'll read from this summary because he says it way better than I could say it. In a world.
I can't do it, but.
Where the conventional wisdom is that retirees should reduce their equity exposure throughout retirement as their time horizon shortens, this research suggests that in reality, the ideal may be actually the exact opposite. In other words, a rising equity glide path post-retirement. A declining equity glide path leading into retirement, getting you to about 30% equities but then increasing it every year thereafter. He goes on, outcomes for a 30-year retirement time horizon are driven heavily by the results over the first 15 years of retirement. That's the first half of retirement. And of course, if the performance is good in the first half of retirement, you got nothing to worry about in the second half of retirement, because even if you're all stock, you will have made so much money, your dividends will probably give you what you need to live on.
Well, because your sequence of returns was good. And that's certainly not guaranteed that it's going to be good, but it can happen.
Conversely, he goes on, if the first half of retirement is bad, like the 1920s, the 60s, or the late 90s, there's a danger that even if returns average out favorably through retirement, if the portfolio is depleted too severely by withdrawals and bad returns in the early years, there won't be enough or any money left for when the good returns finally arrive. This is why, as you well know, John, and I did this long before this study came out, we say go into retirement, make sure you've got 15 years of reasonably safe money to spend during that first 15-year period. Because if you spend from the safe money, if it's good, you're fine. And if it's bad, you're fine. Because the next 15 years, remember, a bad 15-year period has always been followed by a good 15-year period.
Now, if the first 15 are good and you had your non-volatile money that you were spending from, are you as well off as you would have been if you'd gambled and just thrown it all into the stock market? No, but this is why we don't gamble.
So that's the discussion on equity glide paths. And there is a huge difference between what you do before retirement and after retirement. The recommendation from this study and others, by the way, it's not just Kitsis and Fowle, but there are others that have come to the same conclusion, is that if you start out with a moderate to lower risk portfolio the day you retire, and obviously phasing into that is just smart, right? That's what the glide paths, even though I don't like them, the target date funds, do get you to that place. But then you need to change your strategy to one that will support you so that you don't experience a sequence risk with bad market returns early on, because they're always followed by good market returns. It's always been that way.
This is where strategy is the key component of this. And this is where the whole argument about keeping target date funds forever breaks down. This is where that whole stupid argument that you should configure your stock to, you know, fixed income at 100 minus your age. So if you're 85 years old, you should only be 15% in stock.
And it's funny, because now I see, because stocks have done so well over the last decade or so, they're now using 120 minus your age.
So they've changed that now.
Yeah, I mean, this is stupid.
Of course it's stupid.
It's really stupid. I would suggest everybody tuned into this program that you get some kind of a strategy, even if it's not mine. Get a strategy, and then the key is to stick with it. Now, if you happen to use one of the strategies we talk about on this program, and by the way, I don't do this stuff anymore for a living. I used to, but I don't. I talk for a living now. But the academic support for this kind of time-segmented portfolio is irrefutable. It's irrefutable. The old systematic withdrawal way of doing it, while it still can work, it does not account for longevity risk, and it does a poor job of accounting for sequence risk, and a horrible job in accounting for the lack of
decline. There's the potential of cognitive decline.
Is it cognitivity?
Sure.
Okay.
Why not? I'll have to look that up.
Yeah. See.
Cognition. I don't know.
Well, because it's strategery around here.
Well, if you like gambling, I mean, you know, you could take a shot.
I won $1,200 on a dime slot machine the other day.
Well, that's not bad.
I did really, really well.
One dime turned into 12.
No, it wasn't one dime. I think I played five dimes at a time.
Oh, good for you.
Times
50
three,
cents. Hey.
15 dimes, $1.50.
Oh, my gosh.
And I won $1,200.
Stay away.
Stick around, folks. It's the Ray Lucia Show.
Want more business content? is Biz Talk Radio.
Keep listening to this station or take us on the go by downloading our free smartphone app, Biz Talk Radio.
So the AICPA did a survey of financial planners with the CPA designation. That would be a certified public accountant. And here's what they had to say. They said their clients were worried about maintaining their current lifestyle and spending level in retirement. 18% about rising health care costs, though a much lower source of concern. The latter result was 7 percentage points higher than in 2016. So that's becoming, I suspect it's because more and more of us in this business are talking about it.
Well, getting the word out.
Right.
I mean, you can go broke because of it.
48%, almost half of these individuals express concerns about outliving their money, though only 39% of planners shared their concerns. I don't know about that. If I were a financial planner today, and I was one for nearly 40 years, I would be way more concerned than the 39% of planners that are CPAs are. And I'll tell you why. I don't know that most of these CPAs have 20 or 30 years of experience
planning.
And this has been a more recent phenomenon. And sometimes they think, well, the stock market goes up at 9% per year, so they assume it's 9% per year, but it doesn't really do that, as you know. It might go up 29% one year and lose 33% the next. It averages that, and you cannot do planning based on averages. That's why the researchers do all these Monte Carlo simulations.
Right? Are CPAs doing planning?
These are, yeah. These are CPAs that call themselves financial planners. I've met some that are very, very sharp, and I've met some that just do it to get more business.
I mean, personally for me, I'd rather the CPA do the CPA. I'd rather the CFP do the CFPing. Yes. Well, as we've said before, I'd sort of rather have them keep their disciplines separate.
Well, I think it is certainly important that there be some kind of a demarcation line or something like that.
A line in the sand,
North and South Korea or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I would think there would have to be.
Asked about the chief sources of client financial and emotional stress concerning outliving their money, 77% cited health care costs, 53% market fluctuations, and 50% unexpected costs. Those are all very legit concerns. So let's talk about that. 77% of you are citing health care costs. What have you done about it? Have you done anything about it? Has your CPA brought to you any solutions? Because there are solutions, and they're fairly simple. You just got to take a little bit of dough out of your pocket. 53% market fluctuations. Okay, what have you done about that? How are you going to be managing the sequence risk? We just talked last segment about how these 15-year cycles might affect you. So one thing to do is make sure you got enough safe money to last you 15 years or annuitize a certain percentage of your income so you don't have to have that much safe money stashed away to last you 15 years. And 50% unexpected costs. Now, the unexpected costs are more than likely health care. Yeah, I get it. Your engine might blow up, or I need a new tranny like I did last year. I'm really ticked off about that. It's another story I'll tell some other time. Because I don't think I needed the tranny, but I don't know anything about cars.
The transmission.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't got tranny in my fanny or whatever. I hate that stuff. My wife knows more about cars than I do.
In fact, I actually believe she grew up
like Marissa Tomei and my cousin Vinny.
She can tell the difference between a 63 Corvair and or whatever the model was.
Oh, what a great movie. And then longevity complications. So we'll stop it there because I want to move on. But whether you have a CPA as an advisor, a CFP as an advisor, an enrolled agent as an advisor, or just a regular Joe at a brokerage firm as an advisor. Understand, just because they have a designation does not necessarily mean they know what they're doing. Here's what I suggest. I suggest in your very first meeting, you ask them to draw out, to map out on maybe a yellow or a white piece of paper what their proposed strategy might be based on the data that you've given them. You won't hold them to it. Don't hold them to it. But ask them to do that and see how they do. If they say, oh, you're a 60-40 mix of stocks and bonds, turn tail and run. That is not a strategy. That's asset allocation. You can get that in a robo for 15 or 20 basis points. You don't need me or anybody else to tell you how to allocate your assets. In fact, I'll take it one step further. If you were talking to me about asset allocation, I would tell you that in the long run, it's far less relevant than it is in the short run. And here's why. Asset allocation will reduce your volatility, and a reduction in your volatility will keep you in the game because it will help your brain deal with downside risk. But if you were to take a look at Warren Buffett's portfolio, you will see that about 10 or 20 stocks makes up the entire allocation. So the smartest investor in the world is anything but diversified, like an asset allocation model of ETFs and mutual funds would be, that probably has 2,000 stocks. There's no way that you're going to beat the market. What you do with an asset allocation is you beat your brain. It helps in behavior, and that's an important component. But if you really want to make money, I would say combine a core asset allocation portfolio and then do some very targeted satellites with your portfolio. The core portfolio will keep you in the game. The satellites will make you money at the expense of having some pretty wicked bad returns in some years. But long term, the concentrated portfolio is likely going to do better.
You're saying almost a 50-50 solution again.
Yeah.
In some ways. This is right. Not to, and you said this, but I want to emphasize, this is not to put down asset allocation. It is an important component of any portfolio. You wouldn't recommend anybody, especially those who are approaching retirement, to have just, you know, do the Warren Buffett thing in 20 stocks.
I wouldn't, but it wouldn't bother me personally if, in fact, and you got to go back to the strategy, if I've got 20 blue chip stocks or 20 nice ETFs, I could feel comfortable owning those 20 stocks for the next 15 years, buy and hold.
Well, allocation has the effect of dampening down the return.
Furthermore, it's been said with 15 or 20 stocks, you can achieve a level of diversification. You just don't buy Coke and Pepsi.
Meaning that's not diversified.
That's not diversification. But you could diversify your holdings. Now, Buffett doesn't think a ton about that from what I can gather. In fact, he was anti-technology stocks, but now he owns a substantial amount of Apple. Substantial. He owns a substantial amount of American Express. A substantial amount of Coca-Cola. A substantial amount of Geico. That sounds pretty diversified to me, right?
Would sound like it to me.
So I would just suggest to you that in designing your strategy, you can afford to be a little more aggressive in your stock portfolio and go concentrated. But as John said, if you're not as risk tolerant as me, do a core of a nicely allocated asset allocation model. It's what I used to recommend when I did this for a living. I never said everybody should go out and buy 20 stocks. They're saying what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
So do a core of an asset allocation and then go and find a really good concentrated manager. You know one, you just don't know who he is.
I know one. I don't know who he is.
You do know one because there's one like within 100 yards of where we're sitting.
Oh, I can take a guess. I'll do a little radar sweep of where we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, there's nothing wrong with asset allocation, but understand that what it's going to do, the effect of it is to dampen down the volatility, which could dampen down the return. But the idea behind that is to take your mental focus off of volatility and sort of maybe help you sleep a little better.
Well, I mean, just think of the Dow, for example. There's 30 stocks in the Dow. Mm-hmm. They're all big companies. I don't think anybody that's held the Dow for the last 20, 30 years is feeling too awful bad about the performance of their portfolio.
Well, they're not, because they've been holding it for 20, 30 years.
That's a highly concentrated portfolio. But if you go back to 2000 or 2008, many of those, especially value stocks,
sure,
in 2008 got destroyed, right?
Short
but
term.
They've come back. But there's nothing wrong with having Goldman Sachs.
And now today's Bob Evans Food.
Episodes on demand at biztalkradio.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Ray Lucia Show. 844-RAY-SHOW is the number. If you want to get on board, you got to do it quick. Emails at raylucia.com, R-A-Y. LUCIA.com. Just click on the Ask Ray button.
Now, I hope we have time. I want to take a couple calls here, but we had a question from Mark on some of the stuff we were talking about, and it has to do with bonds and interest rates and all that. But
okay,
let's get to the next call.
Who is it?
Ivan. I'm sorry. Ivan's on the line.
Hey, Ivan. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, Ray. So quick two questions for you. One is the two-step Roth conversion still allowed under the new legislation or no?
Yes, the answer is absolutely. You can fund a non-deductible IRA and then convert it to a Roth IRA. There's some technicalities if you have other IRA monies that we can get to. But what's the second part of your question?
Second, different question. So two people own their own residences. They get married, but they continue living in their primary residences. Move forward 5 years later, they decide to sell both of the residences and move to a third state. They're living in different states. Can they each claim $250,000 exclusion since they both lived in two separate residences for 5 years?
Yeah, so what you're saying then is they are not living together in the same home.
Correct.
So one's living in one state and owns a home in his or her name, and the other is living in the other state and owns a home in his or her name, correct?
Correct.
And they've lived in it for like 5 years, you said?
Yes, each one of them lived, well, one lived 5 years, another one lived 8 years,
okay,
and they were just commuting on the weekend.
As the primary resident.
Whatnot.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule out somebody questioning it, but I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that strategy. Can they answer the question, have you lived in a principal residence for the last 2 years, for 2 years out of the last 5 years? And if the answer is yes, and you haven't had other principal residences, they might want to talk to their accountant or their attorney about the ownership issue, but I don't think there's any problem with that, do you?
I can't think of anything wrong with it. I mean, they own two separate homes, one home, they each had a primary residence. You're allowed to sell it if you've lived in it, as you said, for 24 out of the last 60 months. You're allowed to sell it, capital gains tax free, $250,000 if you're single. And you said they are single, right?
No, they're married now, but they separate properties.
Yeah, but they were
when they bought the properties and all that stuff. To be honest with you, Ivan, I don't see any major issue with that. Talk to the CPA though, because is this you or is this a friend?
This is me.
Okay. Yeah, well, stay on the line. I'll do a double check for you, and we'll get your number, and I'll call you back just to make sure. How's that?
That would be excellent. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, hold on a sec.
All right, buddy. Thank you very much.
There's always a wrinkle in there. I thought this was going to go really, really easily. I don't see that there's any issue with that.
I still don't see that there's a problem but there may be something that I don't know.
There are very few things you don't know, but again, let's just make sure, because we have powers that be that
well,
can check
Ivan's,
on things
you know,
like
is a longtime listener of the Ray Lucia show and the Johnny Dean show, for
yeah.
that matter.
I think he's in Portland, actually, so mm-hmm. we've been there a long time. The deal is that you could sell a primary residence, if you've lived in it, as we said, for 2 out of the last 5 years, as your primary residence, at least that long. You can sell it and pocket the capital gains tax up to $250,000 of gain above, that's, you know, above your basis, capital gains tax free.
But I just want to make sure that there's a domicile. I mean, you got to spend more than 6 months and a day in that other state.
It has to be a primary residence. It has to
be a principal primary type residence. So I think they're okay, but I'm going to double check.
All right.
During the break.
All right. Well,
are
we'll
we
check.
Out of time, or we still have time for another?
Well, I want to get one more. I want to get an email here. We have enough time to get one more.
You've
email.
Got mail.
How's this?
Oh, yes,
all right. Mark just had a quick question. I think he has another question, but this is his first one. Mark says, should I buy bonds right now with interest rates being higher than they used to be, and what can I expect to earn going forward?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Mark. I don't like bonds. I've never liked bonds. I think I've beat that one to death on this program because I think there are other alternatives to bonds that in the long run will produce a better rate of return without any downside risk in an interest rate environment that we have right now, which is potentially rising. I don't see interest rates going up spectacularly over the next few years, maybe 1% or so, but that still doesn't bode well for most bonds. So having said that, if you're thinking about owning a bond fund or something like that over the next 10 years, whatever the coupon that it's paying is probably what you're likely to earn. So if you bought a 10-year bond and it's coupon somewhere in the 2.75% range, that's what you're going to probably earn over the next 10 years, even if it's in a bond fund. Of course, if you bought the individual bond and you held it to maturity, that's exactly what you would earn. Now, would I be satisfied with that? No. I would rather talk about other alternatives. I read a story this morning, John.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Buffett was asked that question. Over the next 10 years, would you rather own stocks or bonds? And you know what Mr. Buffett said?
I would say stocks because that's the guy he is, but maybe you're going to surprise me.
He said, I don't care. I'm not going to be here. No, he didn't say that.
No, I don't think he said that.
Charlie Munger's 95. Warren could be 95 10 years from now. What is he, 85 now?
What are these guys doing? I mean,
I don't know.
You know, we
remember,
talk about
rich people live longer.
Living a long time. There's proof right there.
Weekend at Bernie's, man. Whatever.
I don't want
he
to say.
He said stocks. He
yes,
said
of course.
If he were going to own anything for the next 10 years, or that the difference between stocks and bonds, he would own stocks. So my advice would be look for bond alternatives, number one. Now, if you need immediate income, there may be some use for bonds. But typically, people are talking about portfolio diversifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have time to get back into the Zebra Capital study, but you folks would lose all respect for me if I didn't have a study to back up something I had to say, right?
I've never known you not to have a study.
But Zebra Capital and Roger Ibbotson has told us that you could go back 90 years and you would find, if you can believe this, fixed indexed annuities beat bonds with less risk.
As an alternative.
As an alternative.
Even in a rising interest rate environment?
Especially in a rising mm-hmm. interest rate environment, because bonds do poorly. And if interest rates are rising, what is that a sign of?
It's a sign that things are probably getting hotter in the economy.
And if things are getting hotter in the economy, as long as you manage inflation, corporate profits are going potentially up.
Potentially.
They are going up and the market's potentially going up.
Potentially.
If that's happening, then the index annuity will beat bonds. I'm out of time. Thank you, Johnny Dean. I thank you, our callers and our emailers. Now go out, folks, and make it a great day. God bless you all. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Ray Lucia Show, bringing you the best in money information, answering questions about your biggest financial challenges, talking about your money, your business, and your life. Ray Lucia is not a registered representative of or affiliated with any securities brokerage or investment advisory firm. The views and opinions expressed by Ray and his guests are not necessarily those of this station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult with the appropriate advisors before making any financial decisions.
This is Biz Talk Radio, America's home for business talk.